All of us, as schoolchildren, and you too perhaps, used to read that greatest of all monuments of ancient literature that has come down to us, the Railroad Timetable. Who doesn't catch his breath when he ruffles through the pages of the Railroad Timetable? But the Table of Hours, it turns each one of us, right there, in broad daylight, into a steel, six-wheeled epic hero. You're listening to a podcast about buildings and cities. I'm Luke Jones.
And I'm George Gingell.
That strange quotation is from We, a dystopian novel written in 1921 by the Russian writer Yevgeny Zamyatin. An absurdist fantasy of the future in which all human behaviour proceeds according to a regimented schedule, the Table of Hours. We describes the struggles of D-503 as he chafes against the authority of the mighty benefactor and the rigid societal rules which compel him and everyone else to be perfectly happy. We, which we're going to discuss alongside two better-known dystopias, Brave New World and 1984, is a response to the economic and political culture of its time. Extreme political philosophies, the idealization of technology and scientific progress, social Darwinism, all feed into the imaginary creeds of one state, or the world state, or Ingsoc. At the heart of all these works is a fear that technological efficiency and science would succeed in outsmarting and therefore abolishing human freedom.
The books work in communicating ideas and fears about the future by creating places and then visiting them. All of them we see the world through the eyes of a character who is out of place in his world, strangers in a land that may be our future. And to create this, a whole world has to be built, a country, a foreign country, and the society that inhabits it.
Early on, we meet the person you might describe as the kind of tutelary saint or malign deity of the novel, a man called Frederick Winslow Taylor, described ironically in the book as that great genius of antiquity and compared with Immanuel Kant. So, George, what can you tell us about Taylor?
Taylor, who started off as an engineer, this is in the mid-19th century, started working at various steel plants and other factories and worked his way up through family connections and things to become a manager in various firms. He did various other things, like he designed and supposedly developed high-speed steel, which is a strong tooling steel, but he's famous for what he did with the latter end of his career, which is start off as a management consultant, and his idea is all about making the workforce completely efficient by totally prescribing what they do. So the wise manager comes in, examines exactly every motion that is being made by the workers, works out how to optimize it by breaking it down and allow it to be subject to mathematical precision, and then prescribes what the worker is going to do as if he was a robot. The idea is sort of you get down to every movement in tightening every nut on the production line, and that you will have two classes of workers, a management that will design completely the process and the tools of the process, which are the workers who will implement the program.
That he began, or rather got his start, in the wonderfully named Nicetown, Pennsylvania, at the Midvale Steelworks.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like a very happy place, Nicetown. He said this: "It is only through the enforced standardization of methods, enforced adoption of best implements and working conditions, and enforced cooperation that faster work can be assured. And the duty of enforcing the adoption of all standards and enforcing this cooperation rests with management alone."
So the workers are the tools. The workers have no say, the workers have no autonomy, and they would never deviate. He had this phrase, the one best way.
It's the fine tradition of there's two ways of doing it, my way and ways that don't work. And oddly, this sounds like complete lunacy to me at least, but this was the first sort of big management fad. Subsequent ones had developed, but it was a kind of craze that you would get, and it went right through. He starts the idea of time and motion studies, where clever men with clipboards would come and examine the proles at work and note down everything and come up with good ways of doing it, or the housewife, or military logistics, or all sorts of things like that, that really went through, I guess, till sort of the 60s or 70s. They're still doing this sort of thing.
Are they doing time and motion studies? It's a film, I'm All Right, Jack, isn't it?
It was definitely going on in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah. It must have been in the air in order to make it into that.
It's quite reactionary, that film, but I think...
yeah.
It was a different world.
Yeah. It became part of the kind of intellectual climate.
Something absolutely classic I want to talk about with the arc of his career, which is that he came up with these ideas, tried to implement them. This caused massive strife in the workplace. He got sacked. And then he dedicated the rest of his life to messianically promoting them. Which I think is kind of classic, and became very successful at that.
Yeah, yeah, it worked. So he was influential, although in one kind of description of him as the sort of philosopher of monopoly capitalism, his influence actually went as far as post-revolutionary Russia, which of course is where Zamyatin encounters it. This fusion of socialist equality with Taylorist optimization is the ideology which reigns in the kind of absurdist fantasy of we. So, shall we talk about what it's like?
Yes. We takes place in a circular glass city, glistening walls of bluish light. The residents of one state, from identical rooms in parallelepiped blocks, survey a city that is entirely transparent, save for the occasional lower blinds that denote sex hour. Walls, floors, ceilings, furniture and teaching robots, not to mention soft furnishings, are all made of glass. D503, like all citizens of one state, lives his life scrupulously according to the dictates of the Table of Hours, even walking simultaneously in formation when taking a stroll during personal hour. All men are consonant and then three numbers, and all women are a vowel and then three numbers.
Yeah, which is quite limiting.
It's quite limiting for the women in particular. Apparently, as a complete aside, he got this idea from Jerome K. Jerome, who wrote a book called Three Men on a Boat, which is about larks down the Thames.
Yeah, but that's not the one where people have the names and numbers.
No. He also later wrote a completely unknown dystopian fantasy about which all women are even or odd numbers and all men are even numbers.
Okay, but at least there's an equal number of odd and even numbers.
No, yeah, there's radically smaller number of vowels. Maybe there's more vowels in Russian, I don't know. I don't think so.
It could be.
Don't think there are that many, though.
So I think we should describe what the city is like a bit.
It's only sort of described in flashes. We get little bits of it. They go up in a plane, and from space, it is just this dome of slate blue glassiness. It's surrounded by a huge green glass wall, and outside the wall is rampant wild nature. Yeah. At one point, he goes up to it, and there's just all these creepers pressed up against the wall and dark yellow eyes of some wild beastie.
Yeah.
Stare at him. And that sort of is a thing that's in all of these books, is there is a wild nature somewhere.
Yes.
That they're not part of. And that is the strong contrast with culture.
So it's a city of very wide, straight avenues which go everywhere. Everyone lives in these sort of parallelepiped is a parallelogram kind of prism shape.
Yeah, it's actually not a very complicated shape. It's just got a really difficult name. It just means like a normal shaped rect oblong, which has been squashed a bit.
We're in the land of the Platonic solids, basically. The main spaces of the city, cube square.
Yeah, that's good, isn't it? Cube Square.
Cube Square is where they vaporize the quote-unquote enemies of happiness, who are the subversives.
That's something else. All of these have a certain degree of... vaporization is a popular method of getting rid of people. Although the method of, as another aside, vaporization in this one is very different, all subsequent. They're sort of turned into showers of water.
I think it's worth restating how strange the glass vision is. So you have to picture something like a glass hive, in which you can see, and he does describe this in the book, from any room into the room next door, into the room beyond that. And that the apart from these prescribed hours, sex hour, where the blinds are allowed to be lowered, everyone is constantly in a state of being able to see everybody else. I don't know how you put the blinds down over the floor. What happens? Do you think there's a special sex rug?
No, I think there's nothing. I think
Maybe there's
it's like sort of in glazed blinds and they go across the floor as well. He talks about you can see nothing is obscured except for the slight grey frame surrounding each room which holds the blinds. But generally the things in this book are not that thoroughly worked out.
No. It's definitely absurd. It's deliberately absurd and it's surreal. I think that also he's deliberately adopting some of the classic tropes of utopia, so the city is a circle.
It's yeah,
a
everyone circle. From Garden Cities, Ebenezer Howard, Atlantis, the island of Utopia, Thomas More's Utopia, which kicks the whole thing off. Yeah. They're all circles.
This decision to make everything out of glass. I wonder why they make the exterior wall out of glass.
It doesn't make any sense.
Encoded in it is the possibility of its own subversion. Why is it useful to be able to see dimly through the external wall into this wilderness?
I think it makes no sense from a practical point of view of control, but I'm not sure that's completely what the book is about. It makes sense from the view of the dreamlike delusion. And also the sense of a city, it's just glass. It's a glass world. Yeah. The most solid thing in the glass world is air, which through the story sort of penetrates the city in lots of different ways. The atmosphere becomes the only real... Yeah. The two things that exist in the world are people dressed in identical uniforms... and the air they inhabit. And everything else is sort of insubstantiated glass.
The glass buildings become kind of prismatic at certain times of day. And the narrator he's in a permanent kind of like state of high emotional tension through most of the book. Largely through, he's developing a soul. That's what they decide.
Yeah, he briefly flirts with being a soul.
And yeah. It
doesn't go well.
No.
It doesn't go well for him. These dystopian novels, they don't, as a rule, end terribly well. I think we can sort of say that. I think, in case anyone was getting worried about spoilers of these books that are nearly 100 years old.
It's a city which is not really differentiated. There are apartment blocks. There are auditoria, which are the main place that people gather, these big kind of improving lectures and demonstrations at certain times of day.
And also are the schools where the only teachers are robots, because you can't trust people to teach people.
Well, yeah, I guess that's inferred, isn't it? And there's Cube Square with its 66 rings and 66 rows. There's the music factory.
There's music factories, I think. And you, the streets are grids, and one of the entertainment is everyone simultaneously leaves where they are and walks a sort of preset pattern.
The story is all about unanimity. It's a society which is totally unanimous, and they celebrate the Day of Unanimity, which is a kind of satire of an election in a single party state, I guess, where everyone is invited to endorse the continued rule of the benefactor, and everyone does except for one person who's
zapped. he's vaporized fairly shortly afterwards.
The blinds become a key metaphor as well, this idea of the blinds down. So when the narrator encounters the mysterious woman who's going to enchant and entrap him and lure him towards subversive activities, her eyes are described as these blinds. Blinds. The blinds are down.
I thought this was one of the most interesting bits of the book. I mean, I don't think we're going to sort of analyse what happens too much, but there's a lovely sense when he's suddenly in a space which is closed off, out of the normal context of sex hour, he feels like this sort of wrenching disconnection and fear, because a life that is perpetually observed, unified and connected becomes disconnected. And the fact that a solid wall can become wrenching is a really interesting subversion of space.
One of the really interesting things is that I think it does give like a very vivid and strange sense of how weird the real world would seem to a person raised in this kind of environment. So when he goes outside, which he briefly does through a tunnel into the wilderness, the different quality of the light is described as very, very strange. The jaggedness of the light, the like sharp shadows, which haven't been kind of refracted through colossal numbers of prismatic buildings, or the tangledness of the grass underfoot for someone who has walked on glass sidewalks his entire life. Because it's so early, it also, well, part of the charm of it is also the kind of unlikely technological framing of certain things that we've become quite used to. Like, they go on a spaceship, but there are no rockets at this point.
Well, actually, people had, like, Russians. There's a Russian in the Imperial period who starts playing around with rockets and says, we're going to go to the moon on rockets. But they don't. They launch their spaceship with a water tower.
Yeah, so an enormous, you have, like, an enormous accumulation of water in a tower, and it all rushes out at once and then shoots the rocket up into the air.
Yeah. I think this is because the author was a naval engineer. He designed icebreakers. And in the big dockyards in the north of England where he'd been working, there are these huge towers which are to open up and close dry dock sluices and operate huge cranes. And they pressurise water in them, and that gives you the burst of power necessary to operate these things. So it's a technology he was familiar with. Possibly one we're not very familiar with these days.
No, although some of them still exist. I'd never heard of this, the accumulator tower. There's a little bit of English influence on this, because he had been quite relatively briefly in England. But really, this is being written in the context of post-revolutionary Russia.
There's a revolution which overthrows the Tsars in February, and then in October, there's a coup which brings about Bolshevik government. And he came back in between the two. So he's there for this sort of uncertain, optimistic, becoming, with the optimism sort of shattered, period. And then for the start of the Civil War, which is going to tear Russia apart for the next few years. And lives in Russia until the early 30s, 31, something like that. So he lives through until Stalin takes over.
Yeah. The course of the story is a pretty familiar one. There is, there's a hero. He becomes disenchanted. He briefly sort of turns against the system, although never very fully, and is finally defeated. Yeah, and his imagination zapped with X-rays. And the last chapter of the book, he reads over these kind of previous pages that he's written, all of this stuff about his love for this woman, all of his stuff about wanting to overthrow one state, and thinks, I must have been very ill.
But there is also a civil war going on by that point. And he says, I'm sure we will win. But I get the sense that it's not a permanent state. It becomes crystallized, but it is destabilized. I don't think he believes that anything is stable. Which I think is his point about the revolution. Because he's, yeah.
I think something which is very distinctive about it is like a pure negative utopia. Like, it's this kind of, it has the form of utopia. It has this kind of floating, perfect, sort of transcendent oneness. But it's just bad rather than good. The other books which we're going to go on to talk about are much more grounded in, you know, they like exist in a real kind of world.
They all take different positions as to what's going to make it utopic and dystopic. What's going to make it sort of, what makes it futuristic? What the future's going to be like? How it's going to be bad? I mean, it's a complete dictatorship, this place. It's a, like, thought control gone mad. People are executed left, right and centre. But they are sort of willing to be executed. Their subversions are so tiny.
There's no very great sense of threat, though.
Mm-mm.
The mood is completely wrong. There's no...
It's dreamlike. It's delirious.
There's no anxiety. He has no anxiety. He's up all the time.
Yeah, everyone is. But and also, sensory stuff is happening.
Yeah.
He goes up into the sky and describes the air. Yeah. Or he rushes through the mist and all these figures are coming out and there's nothing but... You can't really see the glass in the mist. Yeah, there's just grey figures coming up.
Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, which is written almost exactly 10 years later, is much better known. There are clear commonalities, although there's no clear influence in the sense that Huxley, as far as we know, never read Zamyatin.
He certainly said he hasn't, but lots of people say that he ripped him off.
Yeah.
There's large areas of commonality, but there's also large areas of differences, and lots of other people. We're not going to touch on, but H.G. Wells, D.H. Lawrence, Jerome K. Jerome. These are all people who I, like, don't associate at all. Like, these are the sort of sci-fi stalwarts of Edwardian larks.
Yeah, sci-fi dystopians. Like sci-fi.
It's Lawrence. Yeah. But they were. I mean, and Lewis Carroll as well is another sort of famous one, as well as Americans and Russians and Germans and things.
So here's something they share. Huxley, like Zamyatin, imagines a society in which science has solved the problem of human unhappiness and nonconformity. His solution is much subtler and it's more insidious. So, humans are bred in factories or hatcheries with abilities geared to their future stations as alphas, betas, gammas, deltas, and tiny epsilon semi-morons.
The first scene of the book, which is amazing, tour de force. The book you can sort of divide up into five or six chunks, which are sort of the main elements. But the first one is just a description of some students being shown round the hatchery. And you start, the embryos are created in this factory. Some of them are going to be the masters of civilization, bred up like normal humans in their little test tubes with proper quantities of oxygen. But some of them are destined to be the factory operators. And they're injected with lots of alcohol and irradiated. And then the underclass is divided by the Bodanovsky, is that right, process? Bokanovsky process. And that creates huge numbers of identical twins, like 70 or 100 or 90. And they're sort of destined to be. And it goes through, there's this great spiral. Yeah. And there are jars that the embryos are grown up in. And then upstairs, there's a nursery where at night they're first programmed by whispering hypnotically into their ears while they sleep. And also by Pavlovian responses. So the underclass, quite early on, they're instructed to not like books or flowers. So they're shown a load of books and flowers, and they're all electrocuted. Yeah.
It's a great scene. All the little gamma children are taken into the room. The books and flowers are on the other side of the room. They crawl towards them. And then, yeah, alarms go off and the floor is electrified. and the watching students and the director of the hatchery who is showing them around all laugh heartily.
But also one of the impudent students inquires, why are we telling them to not like flowers? Books is very obvious. And the director says, well, until a few years ago, we told them to like flowers so that they would consume more transport going out to nature. But the trouble with that is, once they're in nature, they're not consuming anything. So we consume them to like things that like transport, but then need consumables at the other end. Hence, electromagnetic golf. And centrifugal bumble puppy, which is a sort of a game where you throw a ball into a tube where it's spun round and spat out of a hole.
I think this spiral is one of the really like key spaces in the book. And I think the embryos kind of migrate upwards, don't they?
So slowly upwards and round into the light, yeah.
So we start off at the bottom with all of the embryos, each in its own bottle, being attached to its chunk of hog perineum.
It's not perineum. It's What is it? Peritoneum. These are very different things. The perineum is the bit between your testicles and your anus. It's not that. You were gagging for it to be that, weren't you?
Yeah, I thought it was great.
It's the peritoneum.
Like, I was like, it's a very specific bit of the hog, which they're cutting out. Maybe they would breed them to have really big ones.
So you'd
have the testes like right up on the body, around the sternum.
It's not that, unfortunately. Yeah. It should be. Perhaps we could. Yeah, no. There's you're missing. It's two extra letters, unfortunately. No.
It's basically a chunk of three chapters, which takes us all the way through the hatchery. We also meet most of the key characters along the way who work there.
Work there, yeah.
And I know we're not really here to talk about style, but there's some wonderful bits. There's this bit at a certain point where it becomes almost entirely a sort of play for the voices. We just go through hearing the voices of the different characters, the voice of the hatchery director as he talks to the students, the voice of the kind of computer voice conditioning the children as they sleep, the voices of Lenina, the pneumatic blonde.
Pneumatic is one of... There are two presiding words, I would say, in this book. One is Ford... and one is pneumatic.
Yeah, Lenina is pneumatic. Or the whining of Bernard Marx, our sort of reluctant kind of hero.
And there's also the dear leader explaining things. And Mustapha Mons.
Mustapha Mons, who's one of 10 world controllers who crops up. If you have read the book, the whisperings of the elementary class consciousness sleep conditioning, maybe some of the phrases you remember. Everyone belongs to everyone else. I do love new clothes.
Ending is better than mending. Stitches. What's it?
Fewer stitches.
Fewer stitches. More riches.
I do love flying.
Oh, I do love flying.
I do love flying.
Oh, I'm glad I'm not an alpha. They work so hard because they're so frightfully clever. I'm glad to be a beta. We don't work nearly as hard. The key things they're bred about is everyone is bred to like their work, like their station, despise the classes above and below them, or like be glad to not be the classes above them and despise the classes below them. And the other key thing is everyone has to be in a perpetual state of emotional infancy.
People in Brave New World do perceive themselves as free. They inhabit a world which is free from want, it's stable, it's secure. What's unfree about them is only their construction and their conditioning, the set of rigid boundaries which they're actually unable to see. It's a story of two men, we've mentioned one, the resentful and unhappy misfit psychologist Bernard Marx, who
he's petulant. So he's a guy who, for some reason or another, although he's really high class, he's too short. And so everyone looks down on him from his class and sort of can't believe. They think he's had alcohol put in his tub while he was growing up.
Yes, by mistake. Someone put alcohol in his decanting bottle.
In fact, later on, there is a mistake made by someone, which is totally incidental in the plot. So it seems preeminently plausible that is what happened. But because of this, he's got a massive chip on his shoulder, and he goes around petulantly thinking himself superior, but also being a total wimp.
It means that unlike his friend Helmholtz Watson, he's only slept with like 10 women in the last 4 years, whereas Helmholtz has slept with 500.
Yes, everyone is very much encouraged to... So all the kids from about the age of 7, they have to engage in lots of erotic play. And some of them are a bit sad. The funny degenerate ones.
Yeah, they're ruthlessly weeded out. Ruthlessly. The ones who don't want to do erotic play all the time. The other man is the lost child John the Savage, who Bernard will encounter on a reservation in New Mexico. They share something which is neither of them really knows how to be happy in a society where everyone else is all the time.
So there are all of the people who are misfits in this book, and there's four quite clear misfits. There are two characters who are the protagonists, and there are two other characters who are also misfits. And they all have something exceptional that meant that they weren't part of the normal. John the Savage lived... So there's the world, and then in the world there are a few reservations, which for one reason or another haven't been civilized.
Yeah.
And they have big electric fences around them, and inside them life goes on as if unaffected. Although it's sort of Stone Age. There's no technology. People are tribal. John the Savage, though, doesn't belong in either society.
His mother, Linda, had ended up there by mistake.
Yeah, a very few people go and do sightseeing and sort of tourism around the lunatic asylum of these, you know, places where people have children and things. And she fell over and was hit by a rock and was unconscious.
Mm.
And because of that, ended up stuck there and stuck there pregnant. And the child, she is like conditioned from birth in the society. It doesn't escape that. But John is someone who belongs in the so-called civilized world, but hasn't had the upbringing.
Yes, he hasn't been conditioned.
So his upbringing is a mixture of his mother, the tribal society that he's in, which has got this odd religion, which is a mixture of sort of Native American, Aztec, and Christianity.
Yeah.
They worship the great eagle, Jesus, and they sort of do blood ceremonies. One of the slightly weak bits in this book, I think, is that it's pretty bloody racist.
Yes.
Like, the Native Americans are astonishingly barbaric.
But he has a third important component, which is that while growing up in the reservation, yes, he is given a complete works of Shakespeare from somewhere, which is something which no one in the civilized world has access to. The world of culture has been scrupulously and completely cleaned of everything from before the great all-consuming war that destroyed the world and gave rise to the civilization which exists now. So all of literature is unknown, and John, who is obsessed with Shakespeare, is the only person in the world, apart from the world controller Mustafa Mond, who has ever read this.
Yeah, does he exclusively speak in Shakespeare in the second half of the book?
But it keeps coming up. Like,
every other sentence out of his mouth is a quote from Shakespeare. It might be worth noting that Aldous Huxley, this book was written in the early 30s. Aldous Huxley belonged to that class and generation where virtue was being literate, ideally in Greek and Roman classics, but also in the great works of English literature. And on top of that, he's a English literature student at Oxford, and virtue of the elite, the best thing you can be is someone who appreciates high culture literature in the mind of the author of this book. And he's got a really strong, like, that, would you agree?
Yeah.
Like, that's really, everything other than that is sort of an inferior substitute. You should be reading Chaucer and Milton and Shakespeare. He doesn't talk about it, but
if it was other people,
it would definitely also be like Latin. And yeah, it's completely assumed. And that world view, in fact, was about to come to an end when he was writing this, but it was looking hale and hearty right then.
We should circle back to where we started the programme and say that Taylorism comes in like this. Taylorism in this world is kind of like God, that people are sorted according to the needs of the economy. Only the managers, the alphas, and to an extent the betas, have any kind of awareness to think. The manual workers are, to coin a phrase of Taylor's, sufficiently stupid and phlegmatic to carry out whatever the instructions are that they're given and never to question them.
I think we should have that whole quote of Taylor's because it's so good.
Yeah.
I can just sort of paraphrase it, which is that he said, the science of producing pig iron is complicated, and anyone sufficiently stupid and phlegmatic to want to work in the process of making pig iron could not possibly understand it.
Yeah.
Consequently, they should have no autonomy at all.
Yeah.
Nice man, Taylor. But the whole society here has gone beyond, he calls it Fordism, it's gone beyond Taylorism, because what it does is Taylor, their society, makes people perfect for their tasks. So all the people who are going to be industrial workers are brain damaged to love it.
Yes.
Conditioned to love it and not above anything above their station. Also, they're bred in huge numbers of duplicates, so the whole factory is staffed with identical twins doing identical tasks, so they're all the same. The economy and the people are both tuned so that you make the people into the perfect producers and the perfect consumers of the things that they can easily produce, and not, so you make them want what they produce, basically.
Yeah.
And also, the amount of work is balanced. So they could cut down on the amount of work, but then people would have loads of spare time.
Yeah, they don't want that. They don't want that.
They just want to balance perfectly consumption and production.
So should we talk a little bit about the kind of world, the city and the countryside and the things which happen between them? So we begin in like the dark recesses of the bottom of the hatchery, but by the end of chapter 3 we're on a helicopter flying off the roof and we see the city from above. And he describes it as the buildings are enormous. The world has pretty much been scrubbed clean by war. There's nothing old. Everything has been rebuilt, and it's been rebuilt as these vast, he describes them as tabletop-shaped buildings. They look
like mushrooms. He talks about them looking like mushrooms a lot.
Yeah. So they get bigger at the top, and I think this is so that all the aircraft can fly on and off the tops of them. This is the main way of transporting people.
Yeah, all the upper-class people, which are basically all the people we talk to, there's no inner world of the sort of underclass. All the men have their own helicopters, and then the women go in the men's helicopters.
Yes.
And there's sort of a lot of macho adjusting of the helicopter screws.
Yeah. It's a garden city. So you pass from a kind of centre through bands of greenery and then to kind of like radiating suburbs. I think the suburbs are still, or everything I think is like big tower blocks, basically. I think it's all
these giant mushroom towers. Yeah.
There's no suburbia, or rather...
No, everyone lives in giant towers. Yeah. There's a bit where they're looking from a hilltop and they see Guildford, which is now seven towers.
Yes.
Which are described to be like seven fingers pointing into the air.
Yeah.
Sort of making a sign to the heavens.
That's
which
it.
Which no one can understand.
He has a lot of fun imagining the kind of material culture. So
there's a lot of light satire. There are some things in there which are just there for fun.
I like that he describes how there are these color-coded newspapers, so everyone gets one.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're all the different classes all have to wear color-coded uniforms, certainly for work. So the alphas wear grey, I think. The yep. Betas wear plum. The gammas wear leaf green.
Yeah.
The deltas wear khaki. And the epsilons are in black.
Yeah. Epsilon semi-morons.
Epsilon semi-morons. Yeah, we like very briefly step into the mind of the epsilon semi-moron operating the lift.
They are given, like in the book, they're given two tasks. One of which is being this lift operator. And what he does is there's a voice in his ear which tells him what to do. So it says, go up. And then he reaches the top of the lift and he's like, oh, the light! The light! It's so lovely! And the voice says, down! Down! And he doesn't do anything. Down! And then he presses the lift button to go down. And that's his life. And the other task they're given is vacuum clean operators.
Yeah. We meet some gammas and deltas late on when John the Savage decides to try and start a revolution.
They're met before then, because there's the point where he actually says the title, "Oh, Brave New World." They go on the fact. So he comes out of the reservation and becomes this big celebrity. And Bernard becomes his gardener and is having the time of his life.
Yeah, suddenly all the women want to sleep with Bernard because he knows John the Savage.
Only to get... Yes, it's the headmistress of Eton. Everyone is like perpetually youthful until they suddenly die. The headmistress of Eton sleeps with him just so she can meet the Savage.
I love this.
And then she can't meet the Savage and she feels heartily cheated.
I love this, that there's a world scrubbed clean by 300 years of like chemical and bacteriological warfare, but Eton still exists and it's still where all the alphas go.
And St. Andrew's Lynx course and the Oxford Union. These are like the three places that are mentioned.
Yeah, funny.
They go and have lunch at the Oxford Union, offer a spot of golf at St. Andrew's.
Yeah. So all
these are probably just the only places that Aldous Huxley knew.
Yeah.
Not quite. Actually, it's not.
But so Bernard, who has been so put upon his whole life and so resentful, becomes a celebrity by association and is having a wonderful time of it. And John the Savage is taken to see a few workplaces as part of his sort of tour of the civilization which he's now entering.
And in the perfect factory, in this case it's a factory making lighting sets for helicopters, he's met by these armies of identical people operating in unison, doing sort of pointless mechanical tasks, you know, operating a lathe, and there's 70 of them, all exactly the same. And he says, "Oh, brave new world that has such creatures in it," and is violently sick under a bush, which nobody notices. This isn't even really noted upon as being slightly odd behaviour.
Later on, he goes to, I can't remember what kind of facility it is, and he tries to make a speech to the Gammas and Deltas there, and in so doing, interrupts the distribution of their Soma ration.
So there's these sort of underclass, and there's this preppy young alpha boy comes down with his lockbox and is going to give them out their pills. Everyone, whenever you feel any emotion as an upper-class person, you take drugs to get rid of it.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you might... The pain of feeling something is really bad.
A gram is better than a dam.
You're looking rather down today. Why don't you take some Soma? Yes, and he tries to incite them against their system. He says, "Don't take it, it's poison."
And starts throwing it away.
And then he starts throwing
it
away.
And there's a riot.
And they riot against him.
They nearly kill... They have to try and hold them off because they want to kill him.
Yeah, and this sort of precipitates the end of the book.
We go to all kinds of places, but it's basically all sort of generic and interchangeable rooms. And what's really characteristic of it is infrastructure. And it's quite a strange infrastructure. There's a tap which dispenses eau de cologne. There's one that gives out patchouli. There's this, yeah, the scent organ.
It's a world of sensory delights. Art is like sensorily abundant, but vapid in content. And you go to the cinema, you grip something with your hands, and suddenly you physically inhabit the bodies of the people on screen. You feel all their sensations. And basically everything is pornographic.
yeah, they're making love
3 weeks in a helicopter.
They make love on the bearskin rug, and you feel every hair.
Everything is sort of the same and different.
Yes.
You can go to the North Pole and you get more or less the same experience. The sensory taps are not quite as good.
Yeah. People complain sort of, it's a bit like people complaining that the television is too small in
hotel. Yeah, yeah, up in the high Andes. Yeah. And the other entertainments is the scent organ, which is, they produce sort of symphonies of smells, where you have, you know, all these different nice things with a little discordant undercurrent of horse shit or something to kind of bring up the harmonies.
Yeah.
But not only the built environment, also all the relationships are interchangeable. Everyone's encouraged to be totally promiscuous. You mustn't... To be monogamous is very suspicious. Someone at one point has been going out with someone for 4 months exclusively. Yeah. He's been sleeping around as much as he can, but yeah, she's been exclusive with him, and this is thought to be very bad.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I think that's partly about creating all relationships are meant to be interchangeable, basically. It's just sort of another, you know.
So there is...
Today I'll have chicken, today I'll have ham.
There's actually a third component to the social conditioning, which is it's constantly reinforced by everybody else that you're around all the time. So that all of these mantras which have like entered your like juvenile brain all the way through your life... constantly kind of coming out of people's mouths.
Everybody's saying them. Whenever anything... It's a very adaptable society because unlike the other two, which are very rigid, when something goes wrong, there's a flash of light and they're turned into dust or water. When something goes wrong in this book, your neighbour corrects you, gives you some drugs in case you're feeling... If you're feeling a little down... and society sort of, it's got lots of tolerance for dealing with, lots of people have their head banged and have to be reconditioned. There's nothing wrong with that, really. Very occasionally, a few people sort of fall off the top and are sent off to an island where they can be happy on their own and not mess up the system too much. But it's a system that's got, it doesn't rely on any element of terror whatsoever.
No, it's almost completely benign. Nevertheless, it destroys... both of the main characters to a greater or lesser extent. So John comes to the world and he also comes back with his mother Linda, who has been destroyed in the eyes of civilized society by being in this savage reservation, becoming old, becoming fat, becoming ugly, and she very quickly somas her way into an early grave. So she's gone, and that's sort of John's crisis, isn't it?
Yes, she's dying on her deathbed, so dosed up to her eyeballs she barely recognizes him, And all around are all these maggot-like children, as he describes them, which are all these crazy identical twins who are brought into the sort of death factory to watch so that they develop no fear of dying.
Yeah.
So they're playing Hunt the Zipper.
Yeah.
What is Hunt the Zipper?
I've got no idea. He's surrounded by all these horrible clones.
Yeah, these horrible clones.
Talking in like squeaky voices. Running around
eating chocolate eclairs.
Yeah. Yeah. So he's kind of destroyed by that. And Bernard and his friend Helmholtz get in trouble by...
Well, Helmholtz is on the way out. So Helmholtz's problem is that he's too clever. This is sort of Aldous Huxley. This is one of the two people Aldous Huxley identifies with, I think, quite strongly. Yeah. Helmholtz is just far too good with words. Yeah. And his job is he writes propaganda slogans to be sort of programmed into people. But he thinks... I've got nothing to work with. This is all vapid. And when John the Savage comes along and reads him loads of Shakespeare, he starts, oh, this is marvellous. And he sort of starts writing his own Shakespeare, gets into trouble for that, realises very quickly there's no place for him in this society. And so when John the Savage causes a riot, he joins in, knowing that he's going to get kicked out of the country, but sort of relishes it. And when he's asked where he'll want to be sent... He says somewhere cold and stormy,
yeah,
because he can write better. Yeah, he can be more virtuous there.
So, yeah. So after the crisis, these characters all have an encounter with the kind of the secular godhead, with the source of power, the world controller, Mustafa Mond. And unlike the other two books in which this person is a source of sort of holy terror, this is an encounter with a person who is absolutely civilized, who's absolutely humane, who is incredibly understanding, and who tries to treat them as well as they can possibly be treated within the rules of the world in the circumstances. So the two alphas are sent to go and live on an island where they can no longer be in contact with the rest of the world and cause trouble, but can otherwise be entirely free. And John the Savage is allowed to go off and live on his own in a sort of watchtower.
Yes. The leader, who's the other guy I'm sure Aldous identifies with, is absolutely the voice of reason. He's completely benign. He doesn't want to hurt a fly. He's very cultured and literate, but believes other people can't be for their own good. It's a sort of white man's burden type guy. And he's utterly the benign dictator. And there's a long section, which is the discussion between the benign voice of terrifying reason and the savage. And it ends with the benign voice of reason saying, this is all for their good. Do you want to accept hardship? All I'm taking away is hardship and pain and suffering. And do you want all of that? Do you want typhoid and the death of the young? And John the Savage says, yes.
I claim it. I claim it all.
And that's the sort of... I mean... He's slightly too nice on Mustafa Mond, isn't he, as a side point?
No, I think Mustafa Mond is like wonderfully terrifying because of like his humanity.
But I sort of have a suspicion, this is written before like Hitler and stuff. Yeah. I have a suspicion that I think it's incidentally very good because we now know in hindsight that it's not good to follow people like that. But I think Aldous Huxley was very on the side of Mustafa Mond.
But Mustafa Mond has a really interesting backstory as well, because Mustafa Mond is the person who Bernard and Helmholtz potentially could have been as well. He also was a little bit too high off the top of the curve. He also was too clever and too unorthodox. But in the end, in the opinion of the other kind of high-ups, it was possible, in fact, for him to take this other course and to become the only other person who's allowed to really be cognizant of the limitations and the sort of design and the kind of manipulations of society, which is the person who actually runs it. He's allowed to be... The person who runs it can be completely clear-eyed about what's going on, and he chooses to allow it to continue.
Yeah, there's a lovely bit... He was a researcher, he was a scientist, and there's a lovely bit where he's going through censoring scientific papers, and there's this new brilliant paper. He reads it, loves it, and bans it for being too subversive.
Yeah. I think that there's an interesting... One of the interesting things about the way the book ends, and which is not... Well, you know, it's like 80 years old. We're going to tell you what happens at the end.
Well, yeah, okay.
So John goes to his tower. John has a sort of obsession with sort of like self-flagellation, with his own moral failings and with this desire to punish himself for them.
He comes from this society which has got a cult of sacrifice.
Yeah. And he goes to this tower on his own, and he likes to work in his vegetable garden and whip himself
before he can even
branches.
Go into the tower, because it's only got a few broken windows and the view is rather nice. He has to flog himself, pretend to crucify himself for a night and sleep outside. And then he's allowed to go into this derelict former lighthouse, which is where the old road used to run.
But he's discovered, and I think this is one of the really interesting things, that he is that there's an insatiable desire for novelty in this society, and it makes even his very, very peculiar and actually, by the standards of the society, like quite frightening behaviour, are incredibly fascinating to people. He likes to stand outside and whip himself, and before long, the landscape surrounding it is full of sightseers who are watching him and chanting, "The whip, the whip, the whip."
Yeah, some reporters longing. There's a nature reporter who sort of sneaks up. Previously, he'd done a great one on sperm whales mating or something. And he puts all these hidden microphones everywhere and he's waiting and waiting. And then John the Savage has some naughty thoughts that he perhaps should have had sex with the beautiful girls who were thrusting themselves upon him, and starts flogging himself. And the reporter's having the time of his life. He's got it at last.
And that's the end of John. He can't live in the world.
They all come, and he sort of and him whipping himself sends the crowd into an orgiastic, because they're so conditioned into like group orgies.
Oh, they start going orgy porgy, don't they?
They start going orgy porgy, whipping each other, and then they all have a massive orgy which he joins in on and takes loads of drugs.
And then he hangs himself.
And then he hangs
and
himself.
And that's the end.
It's a good way to end an orgy. It's really good. It's really good. There are some problems, I think, in it. The thing that's really lovely about this book in comparison with the others is that it's beautifully written. It's lovely. It's funny. There's lots of incidental details which are just there for sort of fun and charm. And also, the other thing that makes it much more charming is that the author doesn't have a clear... He's not, like, trying to hammer home a viewpoint. He's just testing various satirical... He's being satirical on California and the English class system, but he's still placing himself in it.
Yeah, I think so. I think also that this kind of mandatory hedonism, this kind of hedonism as sort of normative, in a way, is also prescient. Like, that's kind of the world that we live in, isn't it?
Yeah.
But also, you guilt people who are not having fun.
Yeah.
Culture is you sort of wire everyone worrying that they're not having the fun that they're meant to be having and that everyone should be having.
Yeah, yeah. And they all have to do it together as well. And the thing that he's sort of very anxious about is he's a bit late for, like, a group orgy. And he ends up sitting next to the wrong girl who's really boring. Also, he's a little bit coy about the orgies.
Yes, no, we don't get right.
It's
a bit. It
sort of. It doesn't get right. It gets to sort of the point where
one of the other like small pleasures of the book is the names we were discussing earlier. Yeah. What our favourite names are.
What's your favourite?
Oh, mine is Benito Hoover.
I like Polly Trotsky.
Polly Trotsky. The main characters are Bernard Marx. Lenin a Crown is his. Well, not unattainable, but just.
Yeah, she's flinging herself at everybody. Yeah. The problems are
His problems are all with him. Yeah. Lenin a Crown. They're all these kind of concatenations of the names of famous dictators and industrialists and like occasional little things taken from kind of everyday normal names as well.
Yeah, yeah. Everything has been sort of equalized, normalized. The other thing that's good while we're talking about this one is that it correctly identifies the economic problems of plenty, which is that there is a shortage of consumption, and a shortage of work, and you've got to create lots of fairly pointless tasks and loads of pointless objects, so that, like, the economy is about creating, like, making consumers and making pointless tasks.
Yeah, yeah.
There's nothing to do in this world. It's all, like, it all could just be done away with, and they've got nothing to do with their time. Like, so the whole society is just set up to give people pointless jobs and pointless things to do in their leisure time.
They basically all work. They all work, actually, on the maintenance of the system of social control whose purpose is to make everybody consume the products.
Because, but the idea is that people can only be happy when they both work and consume, but both of which are unnecessary.
I also think that there's something like persuasive, or that at least rings true, about the way that it depicts ideology. That the ideology in this are these phrases which kind of bubble up with almost without even being contemplated.
It goes too far. But I suppose the idea is that everyone has been sort of, I mean, this is before genetics, but everyone's been basically genetically programmed. Like, the whole of humanity has been subverted into another species, which is about being perfect consumerist capitalists. It's the perfect fusion of sort of Marxist utopia and capitalism. You just breed perfect people. There are bits he gets wrong, though, as well.
Like what?
The Savage Reservation is insanely savage. The bits we see are all about people flogging themselves and sort of this weird, like, weird sort of bestial... They live as animals, basically. It's all about sort of the animaliness.
So from the pleasures of world state to Airstrip 1, Ing Sok. George Orwell's 1984, written in 1948, so the latest of the three, contains nothing ethereal, no pleasure, no colour. A life which is dirty, painful, dangerous, smells of block drains, cabbage and victory gin. Here, the only thing which really works is the apparatus of suppression and propaganda. The thought police, newspeak, doublethink. And we follow Winston Smith, who lives in a drab, cold, dirty room, watched by the always-on telescreen, the universal apparatus of observation. He lives in the future, but it's a future that's regressed and got poorer, more desperate. All that's developed is the state's capacity to survey, oppress, and dominate.
The world is even crapper than it was in the Victorian period when all the houses were built.
Yeah.
It's the best you can do is crappy Victorian tenements that are horrible, or you probably live in like a wooden shack without a proper roof. The world is awful. There is nothing nice. We start in the hallway of his horrible apartment. It stinks of cabbage. There's a massive poster. He's surrounded by propaganda. And as we all do, he goes up. There's no point even trying the lift. Nothing works in this society. Everything is broken. And he goes up to his dismal flat. Although he does have a flat of his own, which seems like a sort of implausible luxury in these days. His flat, which is a sort of awful, decrepit, I guess like Art Deco apartment block from the 30s. He's got one sort of, his main room. Okay, so all people of his class have got a television CCTV camera installed, which is the telescreen. It watches and listens to everything you do and constantly broadcasts propaganda into all your rooms. You can't, there's no way to switch it off. You can just
pig iron production figures.
Hate.
Yes.
The virtues of Big Brother. Down with the enemies of the party. And normally these are set up in such a way that there's you're perpetually under, everyone's under surveillance. You don't know if you're being watched, but you could well be. Which is sort of the Jeremy Bentham panopticon idea. But there's a peculiar tick in his room, which is there's an alcove where he can sort of sit, which is next to the telescreen in such a way that it can't see him. And he's got something unique, which is that he's got a diary he can write in, which is pre-war. And that's the sort of beginning of his subversion.
That alcove is where subversive thoughts take root. It's where he's able to start to become an enemy of the state. From his room, we go to his office. We pass through the city, this kind of shattered city. He passes through all the kind of prole quarters, and he'll pass like on the way to and from work. He's constantly spectating on what other people are doing, and particularly on what the proles, who are the 90% of the population who are not members of the party, he's a low-ranking member of the party, and what they're doing and the way in which they live. He can see, even from his apartment block, his place of work, the only defining features of this otherwise kind of featureless scrub of ruin and dereliction are the four vast white pyramids, which are the ministries of truth, plenty, love, and peace. This is a world in which everything means its opposite. This is doublethink. The Ministry of Peace is dedicated to the pursuit of war. The Ministry of Truth is dedicated to the production of propaganda, and so on. The Ministry of Love is the most feared. It's the instrument of suppression, of ruthless suppression of political dissent of any kind, or any kind of nonconformity, and of torture. Inside the Ministry of Truth, he has his cubicle where he works. And this is described, this environment is, he spends a lot of time in this environment, and it's described in quite an interesting way. He has a desk, and on the wall above it are three holes. There's a hole where messages come in, they pop out and he has to deal with them. There's a place where he can put messages to send them out. It's a kind of in-tray and out-tray, but they're holes in the wall. And in between them is the memory hole, where anything which he has been authorised to replace or destroy is sent through this hole into the furnaces. Then on the way home from work, this is one of the other signs of his nonconformity, he likes to wander. And even when he's doing it, he's conscious that this is a thing which he would have to explain if anyone from the party were to ask him why he's doing it. And within the prole quarters can still be found these traces, these extant traces of history. There's a pub where he goes to talk to an old man, try and ask him about what he remembers from before the revolution. Top hats, mostly what he can remember.
Renting them.
Renting top hats.
And a man once pushed him, and he pushed him back.
Yes. And also an antiques shop full of old junk, where he finds a glass paperweight with a piece of coral in it, which becomes this motif, this symbolic item, which represents the history which has vanished from the world, and which he's kind of consciously aware of the absence of. So he stares into the cloudy recesses of this piece of glass with the coral inside. It's kind of like, this haziness. And inside that haziness is where he's kind of projecting all of this knowledge which he knows has gone out of the world, erased by this vast machine of propaganda.
There were a couple more things I wanted to say about his place of work, actually, before we kind of get out in the city. Because his place of work is one of them quite well described, and it's used as a tool to really set up the world.
Yeah.
The first thing is, it's a huge institutional building with thousands of identical cubicles. The cubicles, you can see all the people around you, and you're constantly not only under the surveillance of the telescreens, but also your neighbours. It's got vast, long corridors where people meet. The corridors are studded with holes that you can use to incinerate any paper. And it's a world where vast quantities of paper are continually brought in and destroyed, because things are constantly published all the time and then constantly revised. There's a whole history of newspapers and books out there, and every day it seems all the history in them has to be revised. Everything is brought in, burnt, republished, to be bought in the next day, burnt, and republished with every sort of little change of...
Yeah, so the actual figures for production of bootlaces will come in, and it will turn out that the predictions made 3 months ago by Big Brother or whoever were, in fact, wildly optimistic and completely out, and he will have to take the article... rewrite it so that in fact the prediction is somewhat below the eventual production figure, which itself is also fictional, and then destroy the original.
And it's sort of utterly insane, the level to which this goes to. At the beginning of the story, the chocolate ration is reduced from 30 to 20 grams, and 30 pages later, the idea is it's being increased from nothing to 20 grams.
Yeah.
And it's this sort of, 20 grams of chocolate, by the way, not very much.
How long do you think that's for?
20, well, it's a week, isn't it?
Weeks.
Which is not even a Mars bar. But there are other things about the office, along with its huge idea. He goes through the corridors and sees what all the other people are doing. And there are these machines. So that there's a fiction department where they write all the novels. And the people who work there are greasy mechanics with spanners, because all of the works are composed by machines. You can trust machines.
Yeah, the novels are composed by... He describes them as being a bit like kaleidoscopes. So in some way, there's a kind of... There's all of these different tropes and events and characters on pieces of, I don't know, paper or glass or something, and they shift around and create different possible configurations. It's one of the ideas I enjoy most in this book, actually.
It's an idea that I mean around... There's the idea of the writing frame, which I think goes back to Jonathan Swift, or maybe I've got that completely wrong.
It's a world in which technology is essentially the same, except for certain defined exceptions, as it was during the Second World War. So there are like big, heavy machines in sort of sheds operating. And all culture, as well as everything else, is produced in these kind of big, kind of dark, whirring, clanking spaces.
In fact, the purpose of a lot of the suppression is to remove all everything that is pleasurable, and remove pleasure from everything that is automatically pleasurable from the life, at the very least, of the outer party.
Yeah, it's definitely a feature that, although buildings of great scale exist, there are no kind of interiors of great scale. There's nothing spectacular. What's impressive is these vast, like, incomprehensible piles of identical, dreary, commonplace things. So yeah, room after room.
It's funny how he really doesn't predict open plan offices, which are way more grim. What it really should be is like a huge hall with... It should be the Ministry of Truth should be a call center.
Yeah.
It should be a huge hall of monitored people.
Something which is noticeable is the way in which these spaces are inspired by things which he must have encountered, and also which he's kind of documented in other books.
Yeah, he talks about both Senate House, which is the first skyscraper in London. Anyone calling it a skyscraper now, I think, would laugh. It's a sort of library block. And also the BBC, which has got the BBC at the time. He was working during the war producing... basically sort of very mild propaganda, which must be some of where the sort of influences come from. And it's the idea of this huge institutional building with hundreds and hundreds of rooms, all looking the same from the outside, doing all sorts of different peculiar purposes.
The other location, which is... He's often thinking about how he doesn't want to have to go there. But in his evenings after work, he, as an outer party member, would be expected to spend time in the community centre, which is a place where the politically correct in this world gather, listen to lectures. Maybe they all drink vast quantities of this sort of synthetic gin called Victory Gin, which is disgusting. And what else do they do?
Sport.
They do a bit of
hikes.
Sport. Yeah. People don't have sex. It's the opposite of Brave New World in this respect. Sex is frowned upon. The only people who go in for sex in a big way are the proles.
Which is almost everybody.
Yeah. I think maybe we should... One of the things which I had completely forgotten, having reread this book recently, the relationship between party members, who are the main, or really the sole targets of the kind of oppressive forces of the government, the separation between them and the proles, who are 19% of people, is very strange and has actually moments which are surreal. So the proles are afforded all kinds of freedoms.
Yeah, they can basically do whatever they like.
They have to work in these kind of quite low status and dangerous jobs.
Yeah, they're just essentially the English working classes. when the working class was nearly everybody. And they sort of fulfill, like, the ones you meet various sort of working class stereotypes. Life for them, it's odd. They don't really, like, he doesn't really have a clear idea of... George Orwell's work, he seems to have these odd class obsessions. I don't know if now is the time to sort of... on my George Orwell rant.
Yeah, let's go for it.
I feel the need to do a George Orwell rant.
Yeah.
This book shows the same sort of... George Orwell grew up as a lower middle class. He attended a minor public school, went out to be a policeman in Burma, became disillusioned with that. And then the core of the rest of his career is both in writing novels sort of based on his accounts and writing journalistic books. There's Down and Out in Paris and London, Road to Wigan Pier, and they are following the sort of trials and tribulations of mainly working people in hard circumstances.
Yeah.
And he's fascinated and attracted by the liberation and exoticism of working class life as he sees it. These people are much more liberated, much more direct than his sort of neurotic lower middle class upbringing. He's very attracted to them. He feels appalled by their suffering, but he just can't get over one thing, which is how they smell and the fact that everything around them is disgusting and so filthy.
So disgusting, yeah. He comes back to it again and again.
He can barely write a paragraph without describing something as filthy, oily, sweaty and stinky. He's just this neurotic... where Aldous Huxley is completely in a world of the sort of upper class or upper middle class, and he sees himself as a sort of cultural aristocrat. George Orwell is filled with sort of lower middle class self-hatred.
Yeah.
And he sees also the world as to being designed to persecute him. In 1984, there are three classes. There's the upper class, which is the inner party, which is like a tiny proportion, a couple of percent or something, of society. And they lead a very monitored, but relatively, like, normal, as we'd think of it, existence.
They get proper coffee.
They get, like, actual food.
They get carpets.
The lifts in their blocks of flats work.
Yeah.
We're not talking about, like a lifestyle that we would regard as ordinary. Yeah. Then there's the working class, who are the proles, who are nearly everybody. They live in sort of grimy obscurity. They work in menial jobs. They drink loads of beer. They're dosed up with loads of porn, which they get in sort of sealed envelopes, which are sent out and sort of scattered.
They play the lottery, which is a complete con.
Yeah, no one ever wins it.
The winners are all made up.
They're obsessed by the lottery, and sort of, it's always the only thing they talk about.
Yeah,
and no one ever wins.
Yeah, the winners are fake. He has these passages which are quite uncomfortable to read, where he talks about how the prole girls go through this brief flowering of being very beautiful for about a year before they have their first child and become fat and ugly.
Yeah, yeah. Have you read Down in Paris and London?
Yeah. I can't remember anything about it.
Yeah. It's suffice to say, this is something that goes through all of his works.
Yeah. Well, to return to what I was talking about, there is a scene where Winston is on a train. He's going to an assignation with his lover, Julia, which is the kind of the sort of flowering of his kind of subversive consciousness and his awakening from his previous life.
To have a lover at all is subversive.
Yes. And he's on the train, he's going to the countryside, and with him in the compartment is a prole family. And he's aware that they have none of these fears. They have no terror of the thought police. They have nothing to worry about. They don't have the same hopes and aspirations. They don't have the same kind of awareness as him. But there's this very... It's a very surreal moment. And the thought which passed through my head when I was reading it was, this is a bit like Harry Potter. Like,
yeah,
Winston is a wizard, and the proles are the muggles. They're kind of like inhabiting the same world. But
he has this perpetual desire, which is, you know, salvation's going to come from the proles. They're basically free. They wouldn't have to do anything to overthrow society. They just have to down tools. Whole thing would break down. World peace and love would break out. but because they're working class, they don't even need to be subjected to propaganda. They'll never do it because working class people have no initiative or will or agency of their own at all. Yeah, they're not even people.
Yeah.
They're working class. It's funny how class... I mean, it's funny how class-obsessed these books are. It's because they're written by English people, these two.
Yeah, these
the one
two.
Written in communist Russia...
doesn't feature at all.
There's no class.
Yeah.
But, I mean, he grew up in a society that was completely dominated by the aristocracy. He's not neurotic about it at all. Whereas the two English ones are completely neurotic in their views of class. And... really, they are the real big chinks in the armour of both of these books.
Yeah. If we return to the architecture, 1984, in contrast to the other books, is really all about the room. Everything takes place in the room. They symbolise, in the period before his love affair starts, they symbolise Winston Smith's imprisonment, his awareness of this sort of futility, even as he's contemplating a rebellion, the inevitability of the fact that he's going to be captured, that it's all going to end. They're also where all the key parts of the story develop. So as we alluded to, the strangely shaped room in his flat allows this rebellion to start to flower. It allows him to write his diary, to reflect, to kind of collect these bad thoughts which he's having and to commit thought crime. There's the office and there's the cubicle. There's an old-fashioned, soft-furnished room above the antiques shop, which has an armchair. I think it has like a gap.
Sort of fireplace.
It has a fireplace.
With
it has
a fender.
It has a bed.
I'm very excited by that.
Where he...
has a bed which is full of lice.
Yeah, where he that's where he and Julia meet kind of latterly in their relationship. It's where their sort of self-conscious position as enemies of the state solidifies. And there's the white-tiled holding room of the Ministry of Love after his capture, where he waits like Odysseus on the shores of the land of the dead. All these shades of his past swim up one by one, tell their stories, and then fade out and disappear. And finally, there's room 101, which contains the worst thing in the world.
His worst thing in the world, by the way.
Rats.
Bit rubbish.
They're going to eat his face. It's not a nice thought.
Couldn't he have tried a little harder? I feel that, like, in these days of sort of CGI, we'd be faced with something like the worst thing you can possibly imagine is rats. Like, I suppose he's had quite a stilted cultural life. And he's had, like, something else. We talked about the shades of the past. Something that people might not remember about this book is it's only set... sort of 30 years into dictatorship, or not even 30 years, like 25. Everyone, or lots of people, can have just weirdly had their memories suppressed.
Yeah, he has this terribly frustrating moment where he takes the old man to the pub to try and jog his memory on things to do with the past, and he can't remember anything consequential. It's all just little messed up.
Because he can't even understand the question of whether life was better in the past.
Yeah. The room always represents some kind of tiny fragment of something larger. So we only have experienced the Ministry of Love as these rooms which he passes through, the holding room, these various torture rooms. But the vastness of it is represented as this like infinite repetition of this small space that we're experiencing.
Like in all the dystopias, a clear architectural feature is that things in the future are interchangeable. The interchangeable quality that starts with industrial production of lots of things being the same through all these books extends to first spaces all becoming the same and then the mass production of people. So people all become the same. Everything is identical so that there is no niggle in the system and it is never unstable. And the rooms, although they're very different and each signify a different, like bring the story on in a different way, his digi room, the room of self-reflection with its hiding point, or, you know, the sort of room which is blank, clean, and waiting your, like, horrific destruction. There also, you get the sense that there's 1,000 rooms that are exactly, or 1,000,000 rooms that are exactly the same as that one. Yeah. Everything, all the spaces are interchangeable, except, in this case, in the prole quarters, where there's a sort of roughness of old life and old buildings, and somehow everything is sort of jump is like it used to be, but kind of worn down.
Orwell was obsessed by language. And one of the features of the book we haven't really talked about is this invented political language of newspeak. And I think, certainly in my view, newspeak is meant to be a kind of scientific or sort of engineered kind of optimal language, which certainly at the very least has echoes of the kind of Taylorist worlds that we've been encountering in the other books. So newspeak is a systemization of the English language, which eliminates all inefficiency. It eliminates unnecessary words, and it also eliminates words which have the potential to frame improper thoughts.
That's it. It's not eliminating inefficiency in communication.
No.
It's not about the sort of Taylorist idea of maximizing production. It's about, for Orwell, word and thought are inextricably linked. And if you get rid of all the words that are associated with subversion, there will be no subversive thought.
He writes it to be deliberately horrifying.
It's actually quite fun.
It's a lot of fun. Shall we listen to some?
But you can tell he's really enjoyed writing it.
Yeah, he has.
He really likes it.
The book has an appendix, which is actually a sort of fake discursive essay on newspeak and its principles and some of its features. He also has a few examples. Where's the one?
When he first gets his office, there's the four instructions he receives.
Ah, yes. Here we go. Times. 3.12.83, reporting BB day order, double plus ungood refs, unpersons, rewrite fullwise, upsub anti-filing. The reporting of Big Brother's order for the day in the Times of December 3rd, 1983 is extremely unsatisfactory and makes reference to non-existent persons. Rewrite it in full and submit your draft to higher authority before filing. I like the one that O'Brien has, which is items 1, 5, 7, approved, fullwise, stop. Suggestion contained, item 6, double plus ridiculous, virgin crime think, cancel, stop. Unproceed construction-wise, anti-getting plus full estimates, machinery overheads, stop, end message.
Yeah, but he's also kind of constructed them to be, they're sort of systematized answer to questions. It doesn't work at all as a language.
No. So the kind of the principles of it are that you don't need like a different positive and negative for anything.
Yeah. It's also, I think it's a bit of a satire on like constructed languages as well. I mean, it's a satire on jargon, except that it's not at all jargony. It's a lot more like Esperanto.
Yeah, it's kind of weird though.
But it's like a rubbish Esperanto.
The heyday of constructed languages is way before this, so yeah. he must be going back a bit. But yeah, so there's nothing is bad in newspeak. There's only ungood.
Yeah, everything is. There's nothing. There's no thing in its antonym. There's just the things.
Plus ungood. Double plus ungood.
There's a funny thing, which is because it reduces words so much, it actually opens up massive amounts of ambiguity.
Yeah,
which is the complete opposite of what it's trying to do.
Yeah, this is a funny similarity which I thought it shared with We and its decision to make the kind of entire city out of glass, is that contained in the essence of the dystopia, there's this unsuspected kind of subversive potential. So it is, newspeak is highly subversive.
There's another thing, which is that the sort of new words for things often, it's the opposite of what actually happens, which is that you become more and more euphemistic. Like, why isn't good sex bad sex?
Well, it'd be ungood sex.
No, but why isn't... But, like, why aren't the meanings inverted?
But, yeah, they kind of are inverted, though.
Yeah.
You see that, like, immediately all of this would just... The words would just be used in different ways by different people. That all of that is there. There's this thing about old thinkers unbelly feel ingsoc or something.
Belly feel is like not being hungry.
Yeah. No, but belly feel is also like sort of like strong emotional identification.
Yeah. But it's also not being hungry, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's both.
So he hasn't really...
It's meant to be removing all ambiguity.
Yeah.
By making one word mean like 30 different things.
But it doesn't work like that at all. It's kind of weird. He's tried to give us this like hellish world without poetry.
It's
but
because
in fact...
he hates. He's like an absolute grammar Nazi, is George Orwell.
Yeah.
He hates the idea that language could change.
So, I mean, what do you think of it?
It's not mad.
I've
been a bit harsh on it.
Yeah, I quite like,
in fact, all of... There's a reason why I sort of know a bit about Orwell's books, because I've read most of them. Not all of the novels, some of which are a bit shaky. But they've always got large chunks of interesting stuff in them.
Yeah.
He just gets some things really wrong and has some weird obsessions and hang-ups.
I feel like I'm being manipulated by someone who... I don't really like or agree with, but the world itself is really full of, yeah, like really fascinating detail, and I really like a lot of the things that he comes up with. I love Newspeak, and
yeah.
I love the machines he comes up with. I like all these like dumb slogans. The world is complete. It's completely like campy. This like ignorance is strength. You know, we're all marching around believing ignorance is strength.
Yeah, everyone's so stupid.
Yeah, it's not believable. It's complete, you know, this is the kind of place that Flash Gordon goes to.
That's something that's way better at Brave New World has stupid and clever people in it.
Yeah.
Everyone in 1984 is completely stupid.
Yeah.
Because he believes that's what society is like. But this is a man who, like, decided he hated English society so much that he tried to grow vegetables on an island off the west coast of Scotland. Dismally failed because he was totally incompetent. And then came back to society and then died.
Yeah, also he had TB. He had TB though as well, didn't he? It's not a good thing to go and live in the
But he's always trying to like roll around and he's trying to like find as much filth as possible, which he has this mad obsession with, and roll around in it. That's what all his works are. I mean, some of them are dealing with very important, well, they're all dealing with very important subjects, but it always comes back to his solution to them is always a weird mix of like paternalism. And so the journalistic portion at the beginning of his books is always obsessed with dirt. And the solution is always paternalism. Like they just need to be thrown out of the way of the benighted savagery and given a bit of a leg up by society. And then everyone can be like me.
Hmm.
Except that I'm neurotic.
Very unhappy.
Love of self-flagellating. He's John the Savage.
He is a bit John
except he's John the Savage without poetry.
So there's a wonderful, I think for me, one of the other bits of the book which I really, really like is the moment of capture, that they've created this imaginary world between them for a certain length of time. They are finally given access to the subversive book, which is the political work by a man called Emmanuel Goldstein, who may or may not be a real person, but is the sort of figurehead of political opposition to the regime and is one of the main targets of Hate Week, of daily 2 minutes hate, which are events where you all go and scream at the telescreen. And they're in there reading the book in their room above the antiques shop when it finally ends for them. And there's this moment which, I don't know if I'm making this up, but it seems like a bit kind of Greek chorus, that they say, he says something like, "We are the dead." He has this moment of reflection. He realises they're going to be caught eventually. He says, "We are the dead." And this disembodied mechanical voice from somewhere comes out and says, "You are the dead." And it's a hidden telescreen behind this picture, which they've been looking at, which is an engraving of some of the old churches of London.
St. Clement Danes.
Yeah. And the voice, they say, "It was behind the picture." And the voice says, "It was behind the picture." And they say, I can't remember what else they say. They say something like, "We might as well."
"The house is surrounded.
The house is surrounded.
The house is surrounded. We might as well say goodbye."
"You might as well say goodbye. And while we're about it, here comes the light to light you to bed, and here comes the chopper to chop off your head."
In a peculiar note of sort of humour from the point of view of, he's quoting them from earlier.
Finding your words, like, unexpectedly repeated by someone you didn't know is there. I don't know where that comes from, but that strikes me quite as, like, a quite powerful work of the uncanny when that starts happening.
Yeah.
And it's a fantastic... transition from one part into the next. And the rest is like his kind of torture and sort of deconstruction by the regime, and then his and eventual complete disorder.
Yeah, the idea of the actual methods of control are not terribly insightful, particularly in our age. I mean, all of these books belong to times that were extreme and not really like ours. You know, this is a book that's written right in the aftermath of the war. Huxley's written in the 30s. We is written during the Russian Civil War, a time of terrific strife and instability. Yeah. And, like, they're obviously very much products of their time and the backgrounds of the people writing them. There's a funny thing in 1984 where the things that are horrifying are basically the experiences of prep school. Like, there's horrible gym calisthenics where you're being watched by this very enthusiastic teacher and you have to bend down and touch your toes. And this is like the most ghastly thing.
Yeah.
Oi there, you! Dirty squab!
Citizen Smith!
Put some back into it!
Smith!
It's all sort of cold showers and doing homework. And he hates sport. Definitely something of that.
So we could talk a little bit... Well, maybe we should sum up with the architecture, if there is anything to say there.
There is one thing that's definitely predictive in terms of architecture, which is that... I mean, this is a process that's been going on for thousands of years, but the gradual colonization of ubiquitous non-spaces. Yeah. The sort of mall, corporate plaza, Barrett home... sort of being stamped all over the country and world, the sort of gradual growth of uniformity that has reached its logical conclusion in all of these books where everything is the same.
So there are lots of later books. In a way, I don't want to talk about them too much because I think feel like we should do a program about them as well. But there are, did you want to mention one or two?
There's Play a Piano by Kurt, was the first book by Kurt Vonnegut. Yeah. Which is quite successful in dealing with something which is a bit absent from... It's got a different take on what happens to a society when you don't need workers anymore. Yeah. And this was written, I think, at the beginning of the 50s. Yeah. He'd worked in some factories during the war which were using numerated cutting machines, using, like, robots, very, very primitive robots to cut things. And the idea is... there's been a huge war, World War III, everyone's gone off to fight. On the home front, it's been necessary to mechanise everything, and all the soldiers come back, and there is no need for them anymore. And that means society is completely divided into people who build, maintain, design robots, and also a sort of political, cultural class along with them, and everyone else who's not really necessary. They're all given loads of stuff. It's not, you know, they're not deprived of anything, but they're pointless. And then there are sort of metaworks as well. There's things like Brazil, which is a sort of digestion, chew up and spat out. I like the plumber in it, where one of the obsessions in 1984 is the plumbing doesn't work. Unlike in Brave New World, where the plumbing is amazing.
Yeah.
Like, forget like hot water, cold water and boiling taps. They've got taps for everything, you know. Everything is on tap. The whole world is at the touch of a button.
Oh, yeah, I forgot. There's this great moment where Bernard's like, oh, shit, I left the eau de cologne tap running. It's going to cost me a fortune. So it's obviously metered. It costs more than water.
Yeah, it's this sort of fun.
Yeah. Not absolute abundance. That's something which is going on.
Yeah, no, it's not absolute.
There's still scarcity of eau de cologne.
But the purpose of the scarcity... But it's a scarcity that's designed to sort of... like production and scarcity and work are all designed to be in balance so that people get just what's right. Which one do you want to go to?
Unexpected, a lot of fun. Obviously Brave New World.
Yeah, yeah, it's good fun, isn't it?
I mean, I fuck all the time and bathe in eau de cologne.
Yeah, yeah. Double alpha plus good.
Double alpha plus good. We'll see you next time.
This is where we would normally say, follow us on Twitter. You've got a Twitter. I don't even have one.
Look.
Like us. Review us on all sorts of things that we're not on yet.
Can you review us on iTunes?
Yeah.
If you're listening to this, we're probably on iTunes and we need reviews so other people who are not our immediate friends and family can find us.
If you're listening to us in a hellish future, don't worry. It'll be all right. And like us on Facebook.